Hello, everyone. I'm Abby Kinney, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hello, and thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned, where we take one story from the news each week that touches the Strongtown's conversation, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. My name is Abby Kinney, and I am a planning consultant at Gold Evans out of their Kansas City studio. And that awesome new introduction music is by another Kansas Cityan named Kemet the Phantom, and that song is called Get Out, the Streetcar Song. I am joined today by Chuck Marone and Daniel Harrigus, who is the senior editor for Strong Towns and one of the founding members of the organization, and I'm sure somebody that you are all very familiar with. Daniel, I don't think we have ever talked in person before. We've exchanged lots of emails in the past, but I don't think we've ever been formally introduced, so it's great to finally hear your voice.
Likewise, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really glad that we've got you on board doing Upzoned.
Well, thank you very much. So today we have a very loaded article, I think, a very interesting article that has all kinds of components to it about housing. It is from the New York Times by Connor Doherty, and it is entitled, Build, 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 Build. I think that's enough builds.
When 14, there are 14 builds in there.
Yeah, exactly. 14 builds. And the subtitle is aptly entitled, When California's Housing Crisis Slammed into a Wealthy Suburb, One Public Servant Became a Convert to a Radically Simple Doctrine. So that suburb is called Lafayette, California, and it's located just outside the Bay Area. It is apparently a place that's well known for being antagonistic against development, and the article really sets the stage by describing the internal philosophical conflict of the former city manager, Steve Falk, who, spoiler alert, resigned from his position as city manager after a multifamily housing project was derailed by the residents in the community, despite the fact that the zoning rules actually allowed the project in that particular location. So at the time the project was proposed, the city manager was described as a localist who really thought that cities should be the ones to decide where and how housing was built. However, after a very contentious 8-year development process that resulted in no project at all, Mr. Falk has since changed his perspective on housing policy from being deeply local to being regional or state level, and that it really shouldn't be addressed even at the local level. The reasoning being that local leadership can't be trusted to ensure that regional housing needs are met because they're at the behest of their voters, their existing homeowner residents who will likely be against anything that's perceived to harm property values of single-family homes, even if that means essentially blocking economic opportunities for future residents. So this is a conversation that is not just happening in California, but has been happening in many states across the country with high-demand cities and rapidly rising housing costs. In some cases, state legislation has been passed to supersede local zoning authority. And that's as a way to address housing scarcity and increasing supply. I think there's a lot of obvious issues with that. But Daniel, I kind of want to put you on the spot because I know that you have written about housing policy before in the past. So I'm kind of curious if you think that Mr. Falk's thinking is in the right direction.
With some reservations, yeah. There's a fundamental kind of collective action problem, or I'm going to get a little, I'm going to go all philosophy on you guys here. There's a prisoner's dilemma problem in the Bay Area in particular is where it's really come to a head, where every local government in an area where you have a bunch of fragmented local governments sort of has one set of incentives. And especially in California, because of the tax system there, because of Proposition 13, which is sort of nationally infamous over the past 40 years, essentially freezes property tax increases to 2% a year on property until it's sold. For that and for some other structural reasons, California cities, generally, residential development is a money loser for them. And so at the local government level, you have this really strong incentive for essentially NIMBYism, or for saying, we want retail that'll bring in some sales tax, bring in some business that way. We might want office development, but we want our neighboring cities to shoulder the burden of housing development. And on the individual level, I think Lafayette, you know, I've been there. I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. Lafayette is a bedroom community. And on last week's Upzoned, you guys talked a lot about bedroom communities and the fundamental problems with that premise. But this is a place that lies up in the hills outside of Berkeley and Oakland that was really designed around this notion of you're going to have tranquility, you're going to have nature, you're going to have birds, you're going to have your single family house on a hillside with a gorgeous view, a lot of greenery, and your quaint little main street. And the residents of Lafayette, of course, they don't want 315 new apartments full of people whose cars are going to be on their roads. It's essentially all downside for people who self-selected into that community. The problem, of course, is that the Bay Area has a housing affordability crisis. There is a need region-wide for a lot more homes. And so it's not sufficient anymore to say that individual local governments get to play a game of hot potato and say, we don't want to build the housing, you build the housing. I think you layer onto that the factor that Lafayette has a BART station, Bay Area Rapid Transit, with a really speedy train connection to all of the jobs in San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley. The development project that's profiled in the article is an empty field in front of that BART station. So you've got some real incentive problems. I don't subscribe to the radically simple doctrine that the article talks about. I am allergic to radically simple doctrines. I also think there's an undeniable problem here that can't be resolved by simply saying every city gets to make this call for itself of whether and how it's going to allow new homes to be built.
Well, that's really interesting. And it actually kind of surprised me that there's this BART station that is placed right in the middle of the community. And I don't know if there was a discussion about what might go next to a BART station, but currently it's basically a bunch of parking lots so that people in the community, I guess, could drive to the parking lots, park there, and then get into San Francisco or the larger Bay Area. To me, it seems interesting that development was not a discussion or not an expectation with the investment of a BART station.
My understanding is that the zoning on that site actually allowed this project. It allowed these 315 apartments. So to the extent that you can say whatever's in the zoning code is the product of some sort of a community decision, it strikes me that there was an expectation, just not one that was necessarily in the heads of the residents of Lafayette who didn't have a majority vote on that zoning designation.
Yeah, and that's definitely not the end goal of any planning process, is to have majority votes on every single development project that comes through the pipeline. That would just be a complete nightmare. So I see how this could really be addressed better at a regional level. Chuck, what do you think? Do you think that giving this power to the state is the right direction here?
So you asked me that question. Daniel and I have talked about like our need to write a book about this someday, just the whole issue of housing. And this is one of those places where I think we philosophically like agree on a lot of things, but maybe start from a different place and our agreement then diverges at some point a little bit. I think we both agree that like housing is the wickedest of wicked problems. I mean, when I first saw this headline, you know, build, 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 written 14 times, like that's the answer, I just shake my head. And I had all kinds of people email it to me and say, here's, you know, Chuck, this guy's speaking your language. I'm like, no, he's not. Because it's an oversimplification to say like building will solve things, you know, be a solution to these wicked problems. But at some sense, like you get to the point where you're just like, darn it, somebody go and build something, you know, like there is like things that would be alleviated if we could just do this. And I guess I've grown a little more sympathetic to the notion that we've created such a disaster for ourselves, especially in states like California, where maybe we do need some type of reform that says, you know, just get out there and build. When I look at this particular situation, why in the world did we, and I'll say we in a large we, the federal government, the state government, regional government, why did we invest in, you know, billions of dollars of BART transit without like a commitment or a plan or a guarantee that there would be a return on that investment with development around the station? If this were a private sector undertaking, we would never have built that line without some end game plan and some end result for how you were going to increase land values around it, how you were going to get a return on that investment, how you were going to get riders and et cetera, et cetera. As governments, we tend to not bother with those things. We would like a train. A train is really nice. It will reduce congestion. It will help with CO2 emissions. Let's build a train. And I think if there's a takeaway here from a strong towns perspective, it's the idea that, you know, it's oversimplistic to just look at these things in one dimension, whether it's a train development or a housing development or what have you. You actually have to ask a deeper set of questions. And if you don't do that, you're going to end up, you know, with overly simplistic solutions to what really at the end of the day are complex, you know, complex human systems that don't take well to like simple rote responses.
Yeah, I think the idea that this is a radically simple doctrine, as they put it, is just completely unrealistic because of how complex this discussion is. I know it's a discussion that is happening in more than just California, which I don't know that the correct housing policy for California is also the correct housing policy for other states with different levels of demand. To me, the idea of the state having broad authority on local zoning regulations does seem a little bit misguided because, well, it seems pretty disingenuous for the state, which is the entity responsible for subsidizing massive amounts of infrastructure on the outskirts of metros, to now tell local governments that they no longer have the authority to determine how housing should be regulated. But I wonder if there is an approach that empowers local governments to address regional housing needs in a way that is locally nuanced. I'm not actually convinced that the state is even the best entity for addressing housing needs at all. And I wonder if instead MPOs have a role to play on regional housing policy.
Well, let me throw this out. And I'd like to see the both of you respond to this notion. You know, when we think of like the MPO is this very directed, very focused government entity working on transportation. And anybody who's gone through the training that the three of us have gone through has certainly been exposed to the relationship between land use and transportation that when we get to government policy is just almost completely blind, right? They're like two different walled off entities that are clearly designed to be together. Here's my supposition. In California in specific, where you have recall, you have referendum, you have, you know, all these kind of voter initiatives that you can do to affect policy, why in the world does anybody think that it's going to be successful to have the state actually, you know, direct and demand local land use? Is this something that is viable over the long term? Because it seems to me like if they're successful in having like the state or the region, you know, force through things that local people don't want, that ultimately you're going to get a Prop 13 situation where local people are going to say, hey, we're going to overrule that with a vote. And then we're actually in like a worse position than if we just rolled up our sleeves and said, you know what, we're not going to deal with this problem with a big hammer. We got to be more nuanced. I don't know, Daniel, if you've got a thought on the dynamics of California and the pushback you would expect on something like this.
I can really easily envision a lot of ways that this goes really bad, and not even so much in the near term, but yeah, say the California version of the YIMBY movement, which has really been focused on statewide legislation to sort of steamroll local recalcitrants, say that these efforts are successful. I think you're right that this is sort of the mother of complex problems that don't lend themselves well to sledgehammer solutions. And I think it would go bad 20 years down the line, 30 years, 40 years down the line in ways that nobody's anticipated yet, or maybe that we can anticipate. But I mean, I certainly think the Prop 13, the moral of the story has a lot to do with that. At the same time, I understand why the debate has gone in the direction it has, and it frustrates me. And I talk with a lot of California housing advocates, and I sort of cut my teeth on these issues as a San Francisco resident, reading about them and thinking about them before I went to planning school, before I was involved with Strong Towns, any of that. So I've been immersed in these issues for a long time, and I'm sympathetic to why the debate has gone in the direction it does, that it has. It's a notion of, you know, people who are driven by moral urgency want to use the tools available at their disposal to solve a problem. And that means playing the game of politics. That means, you know, you have this kind of multi-headed hydra legislation that has been proposed in California year after year after year to try and crack this housing problem, which fundamentally I still think is a prisoner's dilemma problem, where you need to have something above, you know, purely local self-interest at stake, and you need to align incentives differently. But instead what we get is, well, the state is going to designate all these areas. We're going to have transit-rich areas. We're going to have job-rich areas. We're going to have sensitive communities. We're going to map everything out and have these really convoluted maps. High fire-risk areas. We're going to mark out where all of them are, and then we're going to set housing targets for all of them. And, like, that's just... It's
can
a
we
mess.
Ever see that working? I mean, that's the no, to me, when I get into that thing and I start looking at it, I'm like, I mean, Abby, you're the practicing planner. Can you imagine a scenario, and particularly in a place where you have like this legacy of very local involved activism? Can you imagine a scenario where that is actually like a viable governing strategy over, you know, over a decade or two?
You know, that's a really good question. And I don't know that I have a good precedent for something like that. And I certainly have a hard time seeing that being viable in the long term. At some point in the article, they describe that this is really going to require some sort of mind shift or cultural shift in the way that we look at building housing in this country, which I think the author was correct by saying that. And I don't know how we get to a cultural shift. I think that is a lot easier said than done.
Part of the rhetoric of California YIMBYs, which has been, you know, it's really off-putting to some outsiders who aren't versed in that culture and those movements. I think it can be off-putting, or it can be just outright baffling, the whole build, 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 and kind of the deliberate obnoxiousness of some of these advocates. I mean, the article talks about SF BARF, the Bay Area Renters Federation, which was sort of a gadfly activist group. They chose the name BARF knowing exactly what they were doing. I mean, they wanted to grab attention. I think there's value in moving the Overton window. Should we have neighborhoods that are zoned for nothing but single family homes? That wasn't even a question anyone was asking 10 years ago. And it's a question a lot of people are asking now. And I think the sort of stridency of some of the loudest advocates in this movement has a lot to do with that. You know, now that it's on the cultural radar, I'd like to see it go in a different direction. And it's a direction that, you know, I've described in writing for Strong Towns, I've described as more of a via negativa direction, to borrow that term from Nassim Taleb. I think there are ways to turn that sort of popular anger and that moral urgency in this mass movement into effective top-down action, effective top-down legislation, but it needs to be something that is radically simplifying rather than layering policy distortion on top of policy distortion. It needs to be something, in other words, less like what California has toyed with and more like what Oregon did last summer, which was a really simple piece of legislation with a broad coalition supporting it that said, if you're a city of more than 15 or 20,000 people, I don't remember the number, in the state of Oregon, and you have residential zones, you have to allow up to a 4-unit building on any given lot. You can't only allow a single family house. You have to allow a duplex or a triplex or a fourplex. But we're not going to micromanage. The legislation didn't come accompanied by a bunch of maps and a bunch of criteria. It was this is it. If you're going to allow this, you have to allow that. What that actually does is it starts to shift the underlying incentives for how local governments do regulate development and how they look at their land use future in a way that I think is productive rather than distorting. I think the policy shift will help push the cultural shift along too, as people start to see this as familiar and not scary.
Yeah, well, I think that approach also sort of aligns us with what can be financed through conventional methods. A lot of people don't know that you don't have to just buy a single family house through a mortgage. You can buy up to 4 units. So thinking about how we buy our own owner-occupied properties is also a cultural shift. And you don't have to buy a single family house. And that's not the only version of the American dream. So enabling that through zoning, but also through the financing is, I think, really important to make those matchups. I think that we could talk about this all day, but we are running out of time, unfortunately. And I would like to take a couple of minutes to transition to the down zone, where we've have an opportunity to share what we've been listening to, watching, reading, or just things that we have been doing. Chuck had a special request that he would like to talk a little bit more about the local Kansas City artist behind the new theme music for this show. So Chuck, go ahead and take it away.
So I do obviously a lot of public speaking and traveling around the country. And as part of that, there's always people tweeting at me or around me, including, you know, me in their tweets. And especially when I'm out speaking, there'll be this list of people who say, oh, I'm going to see, you know, at CL Marone or what have you. When I was in Kansas City, I had this one guy named Kemet the Phantom who, you know, said, I can't wait to go see Chuck Marone speak tonight. And I got this while I was about to go on stage. And I thought, like, who is this? Like, what's going on here? And I kind of checked him out and I'm like, well, this looks very interesting. He's a musician. He's a rap musician from Kansas City. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that like are outside of what kind of, I think the normal interaction for me would be at an event like this. Afterwards, this guy comes up and he's like, hey, I'm a huge Strung Towns fan. I love your work. I got turned on to you through a friend, a mutual friend, a guy named Kevin Klinkenberg, who writes for Strung Towns, has been a big part of our conversation for many, many years, a good friend of mine. And he said, you know, I chat with him and he's like, here's what I do. And I do music and check it out. And I went home that night and I turned on his music. And I got to say, I really liked it. Like I had a lot of fun. This particular song that we're using now for our bumper music, the streetcar song, my kids like it. I turned it on for them while I'm taking them to dance. I'm like, oh yeah, I like this song, Dad. And when we talked about relaunching the podcast here, I said, I would love if Kemet the Phantom would do our bumper music, and got a hold of him. And he's like, oh, I would, he was just really, really gracious and said, you know, that would be an honor. And so I don't know. I just wanted to take a couple minutes at the end and just say, we're reaching a lot of interesting people with our conversation. Our conversation is really broad and bringing in people from a whole bunch of different spectrums, not just, you know, the planners and architects and engineers that are professionals, but, you know, rappers and musicians. And they've got beautiful contributions to make, not only to our movement and our conversation, but to the communities they live in. And, you know, if you haven't checked out Kemet the Phantom, go do it, because he's a guy not only making fun music, not only making people smile and, you know, lighting up people's lives, but out there advocating for Strung Towns and trying to make his place better. So I just want to say thanks. And I thought it was a real coup that we could get him in as part of this whole thing.
Yeah, being able to use his music has been a real treat. And I'm glad that I've been introduced to all the different songs that he's created. I actually was not familiar with him before Chuck introduced me, which should have been the other way around. But I think that his work is so great, and I'm glad that we're using this streetcar song, which is, by the way, perfect for this show. And it has a really cool music video that actually takes place on the Kansas City streetcar downtown. So it is pretty cool to see that. And I've shared it with several people because it's a genuinely good song.
Well, let's cue it up on the way out.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you for listening to another episode of Upzoned. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Thanks.